Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Today's cool fact of the day is that the single most searched nutrient on the internet is vitamin C, which is kind of cool because it has some amazing powers a lot of people don't know about. Today's show is one of the more fun ones because my guest slash co-host here is in the show with me, Dr. Mark Atkinson. And what we're going to do today is answer questions that you've sent in via the blog, via social media, and some of the questions are recorded live from the Bulletproof Biohacking Conference. Tons of questions come in every day, and I totally appreciate it, and I want to answer them all, but there just isn't time to answer all of these. Even if I stopped seeing my family and cloistered myself here at Bulletproof Labs, I still wouldn't get to all of them. So if you're an avid listener and I didn't answer your question for you, join the Bulletproof Forums. You can just go to forum.bulletproofexec.com, and there's a whole community of people whose net knowledge is much greater than mine or Dr. Mark's anyway.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat Cold Tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
And if you're not familiar with Dr. Mark, he's been on the show before, but if you're a first-time listener, Mark is a British physician and really an internationally renowned pioneer in integrative medicine. And we're just hanging out here on the set and just here to answer questions. So this is one of my favorite things to do. Mark, happy to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you again. You know, I love this. I love the fact that people take the time to write in with questions, you know, to call in with questions, because what it does, it really makes me reflect on it because, you know, a lot of people listen to this. And, you know, we're both committed to making this as helpful as possible. You know, and we take this seriously. It's like, you know, there's a responsibility that comes with sharing information and knowledge. Hopefully we can explain things in simple ways and give people insights maybe they haven't, you know, thought of before. So let's see what we can do.
All right. This will be fun. Before we get started on questions, actually, have you been working on anything for your own personal performance? Any cool biohacks? Any big things you've figured out lately?
Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff. So maybe the biggest one for me is I've been learning a lot about using breath.
Okay.
And I think this is going to be the theme for me this year is like, I never fully appreciate how important it is to take charge of your breathing. And So twice a week, I do like a 5-kilometer run. I live next to the ocean. I'm very privileged to be, you know, next to the ocean. And I go for a run. And I've been learning about the importance of actually synchronizing your breath as you place your foot down on the ground, but focusing on breathing through your mouth rather than your, sorry, focus on breathing through your nose rather than your mouth.
That makes a lot of difference.
So what it looks like is, it looks like this. So when I breathe, I go. And every time there's an in-breath or out-breath, my foot gets into a pattern and they basically synchronize. Now, here's the deal. For ages, my best time for 5,000 meters was, you know, about 28 minutes, which is, I don't know whether that's good or bad. So I started this new kind of style of breathing, and I shaved 90 seconds off my best time first time I go out there. Wow. And here's the other deal. I'm like feeling all this energy whilst I'm running and after running as well. So what I'm starting to learn is that the way we breathe really matters. A lot of people chronically overbreathe, they mouth breathe, they hyperventilate, and you can actually train yourself to focus on breathing through your nose. That's really important. You know, we're designed to breathe through the nose. Yeah. You know, the hairs capture the particulate matter. We get nitrogen oxide from the nose as well, which is a bronchodilator, vasodilator. It has antimicrobial properties. And you feel great. So that's been a big breakthrough for me. Just by tweaking my breathing, I can upgrade my physical performance. And you know what? Really enjoy running. Just feeling that kind of energy in my body. So that was just great. And a very simple hack.
So that sounds a lot like the Tibetan breath of fire. And I've done some meditative practices where you do that same thing, where you have like an in-breath that's punctuated. And even some of the art of living, breathing is around very, very rapid, short things.
Yeah.
And it's something that's not taught in almost any of the exercise kind of things, even on the some of the really, really aggressive exercise programs. Mm-hmm. They don't talk about breath at all.
Yeah.
But it's something where they might say, you know, take a deep breath and relax or focus. But maybe it's not always about a deep breath. It could be overbreathing, it could be underbreathing, it could be in the wrong hole, it could be at the wrong timing.
Yeah.
And the science of this has come a long way recently.
So we cover this in Bulletproof Coaching. We've got a whole section on using breath. And what I'm realizing is it really is central to everything.
Yeah.
Anyone who practices meditation or mindfulness, you learn how to keep bringing your attention back to your breath. When you start to realize, wow, I breathe through my mouth a lot of the time, that's a very ineffective way of breathing. Or people breathe too quick, or they don't breathe into their lower belly. Now, the bellows breathing is this amazing, energizing breath hack, whereby if you're noticing that your energy levels are low and you just want to perk yourself up pretty quickly, all you do for about 10, 15 seconds, you go. And that sounds a little bit strange for people who can't see what I'm doing.
You're basically breathing in and out through your nose very quickly.
Very, very quickly. Okay. Equal duration length of the in-breath and out-breath. And you're using, and it's called bellows breathing, because you're literally using your diaphragm as a bellows. And it's like, hey, 5-10 seconds, I'm feeling energized, more focused, more alert. And this is the kind of cool thing with biohacking, is like you learn how to take charge of your biology. If you show up in a state in which you're not feeling fully energized and alert, and that situation requires that of you, you can change your state and you can use your breath to do that.
Since we're talking about breath, and brother, we didn't plan to do this at all. It's kind of fun. There's another thing I learned. For about 5 years, I did Art of Living breath work every morning. And every Saturday, I'd go, at least most Saturdays, I'd go with a group of really successful entrepreneurs. Mm. And we'd like 7 a.m. on Saturday morning go do this crazy breathing, because like it was kind of like taking a mental shower. But there's a breath that we learned called, I think they call it the caffeine breath. And I'm sure that there's a name in Sanskrit that I don't know for it.
Yeah.
And you got to see this on video. If you're driving your car, I'll just try and describe what I'm doing. But what you do is you put your arms up above your head, and then this will make weird noise on my microphone probably too. And then as you're breathing out, as you're lowering your arms down, you drive them down almost into your ribs, and you breathe out through the nose like this. And you do that just a few times. And you can actually, like, if you're fading in a meeting, you can actually like go into the bathroom and do 3 of those. And it totally wakes you up.
Shifts your state, right?
It shifts your state in a major way. And so there's all these breathing hacks that I think were mostly studied in probably India
and
China. And actually the Russians are super into this stuff too. If you look at like Russian System A and some of the other martial arts, there's a lot of that. But it's fascinating. And I think not enough attention has been paid in the biohacking community to breathing. So We'll make it the year of breathing.
Yes. Same for the medical community as well. Is like, we never get taught about how to breathe properly. And I'm realizing if you care about your energy and performance, and you care about training your mind to be able to pay attention and keep focus on things that matters most to you, you have to learn how to regulate your breathing.
So when we're done with this, we should head downstairs at Bulletproof Labs. We could breathe 100% oxygen far beyond 10 liters a minute while under an exercise load. Yeah. Or we could breathe no oxygen under an exercise load and see what happens there. Because I'm spending a lot of time lately manipulating oxygen levels in the blood with some pretty profound effects that over the course of the year I'll be talking about. So it's a neat time to be looking at all this.
It's very cool. I'm pretty convinced it's the cutting edge of the biohacking, but there may be some people who have been using breathwork for a long time going, this is kind of obvious stuff. But I think, we're starting to learn a lot more about it. And I think for anyone listening to this is like, you can read about simple things like Pateco breath method. You mentioned the art of living. Look it up, Google it, just read around the subject a bit, practice some of the breaths. One of the breath techniques that I teach a lot of my clients, particularly those who are stressed, feeling tense, feeling a bit anxious, is a relaxation breath technique called 4-7 breathing. You breathe into the count of 4 through your nose, out to the count of 7 through the nose. So much longer out breath. And what happens when you focus on the prolonged expiration, it triggers the body's parasympathetic nervous system, which triggers the relaxation response. And hey, presto, in like 2-3 breaths, you just got this wave of calm on the inside. So you can energize yourself. You can calm yourself in pretty short period of time. It's pretty cool. Okay. Well, should we go on to the first question?
Let's get our first question. This looks like it's Bjorn from Bangkok.
Hello, Dave and Mark. This is Bjorn calling in from Bangkok, Thailand. Thanks for hosting a great show. So I have a question regarding fat adaptation. Is fat adaptation really black and white? Meaning, are you either fat adapted or not? And is there a danger to eat too many carbs for ketosis, but too few for optimal energy levels?
So that's two questions. And fat adaptation is not a binary state. It's not a zero or a one. It's a sliding scale. So can you relatively easily burn fat, or do you almost not burn fat at all? If you've been a raw vegan or a raw low-fat vegan for a while, man, you're going to really not make lipase, the thing that you require, the enzyme you require in order to digest fat. And it's probably going to make you have an upset stomach when you eat it. And you're going to need to take betaine HCL and take lipase until you can turn your pancreas back on to make that enzyme and your liver. And that takes at least 6 weeks. So certainly you can be at one end of the spectrum or the other, but you're never going to be zero fat adapted. There's a name for that. It's called death. If you can't metabolize fat, you're probably going to die eventually and not that far away. And then I don't know that there's anyone out there who only burns fat without any protein consumption turning into glucose, because you'd probably also die from that. So you're going to be somewhere in the middle between those extremes. What do you think?
Yeah, so you basically do what works and what energizes you. And so for a lot of people,
like heroin?
it's kind of, okay. And also, the caveat is also whatever's legal as well. I should always do that caveat. So here's the deal, is that we can run off both fat and glucose. And in reality, that's what a lot of people do.
We all do.
We all do. And that's normal. That's healthy. And if you want to be strictly keto adapted, you have to significantly reduce your carbohydrate intake. It has to normally be less than about 20 grams of carbohydrate per day. I come from the clinical world. My experience using ketogenic diets is people with cancer. And what we found is that you have to get the carb levels down really low, even like down to 12 grams per day. You have to restrict protein intake as well, because excessive protein can convert into glucose as well. But the reality is that's really hard to stick at and do. 95% of you go on the ketogenic diet will not stick with it because it's too hard. So what you do is you bring on the exogenous sources of ketones, such as brain octane.
And there's also a question of what level of ketones you need. And this is one where it depends what your goals are.
Depends on your goals.
Right. And if it's anti-cancer, you need to be eating these very low things.
Yeah.
And even then, there's a question of how long should you eat that? And we have a bunch of Bulletproof people going to Dominic D'Agostino's conference coming up here around ketosis. And he's one of the leading cancer researchers there. And I can say, I don't think we know, like, is 2 weeks long enough? Is 6 weeks? And if you come out, how frequently should you come out for cancer?
Yep.
But I believe, and this is why the Bulletproof diet is structured as a cyclical ketogenic diet, is that if you don't come out occasionally, there's probably a biological cost of doing that. That said, there are people who have been in ketosis on very low carb diets for years, and it totally works for them.
And they feel great.
My experiment didn't succeed there. Like I was totally willing to, like, I'll be an Eskimo. I'm fine with that. So when I tried to do it, after about 2.5 months, I started getting really dry eyes. I started getting really dry sinuses, and my sleep quality just went away. And like something was clearly not right. And what ended up happening was I developed some food allergies because I couldn't make enough mucus to make the lining of my stomach, or tears, or basically mucus in the sinuses. And so I was deficient, and I couldn't make enough carbohydrate from protein in order to make the polysaccharides that are there. And my total carbohydrate consumption was one serving of broccoli a day. And I ate some meat and just tons and tons of fat. So I was very religious about this, and it was not a good outcome for me. I'm still just about done with those food allergies. There's still a couple I'm working on. So that won't happen to everyone. But one reason a lot of people go on low carb or extremely low carb ketogenic diets is they're going to starve the candida, which is a form of yeast, right? It is little known in alternative health circles, but it's well documented in a study. Yeast can eat ketones just fine.
Yeah.
You're not going to starve the yeast by going on a low-carb diet. You avoid sugar, which can be really helpful, but for proper immune system functioning, you might even need a little bit of starch. Not a lot. You don't want to overfeed the yeast, and there's a great argument for going on a zero-carb diet for a while taking antifungals and then switching back to carbs. But I think that long-term ketosis without a break is maybe appropriate in some situations, but for the average person, having a break from ketosis, even if it's a one-day break, so your body has some building blocks, it's probably worthwhile.
I'm much more realistic for the average person. So, you know, most of the time I'm a low carbohydrate diet once a week. I increase my carbs. I feel great in there. And that's what you got to do. It's about personalizing the diet to you, to what your goals are, your energy, your performance, using like brain octane to supplement the ketones. You only need to increase the ketone levels, just a very small amount in the blood, right? You know, so you don't actually require that kind of much. And play around with it. That's one of the joys of biohacking, is you're experimenting, and you're experimenting what works for you. What works for another human being is not necessarily good for you as well. So bring in flexibility to it. Have that kind of curiosity and experimental attitude as well.
There's some cool studies around the level of ketones. And so I expect, well, you know, I have to pee until the stick is purple on the ketone test strip, or, you know, I want a level of 2.0 or higher, or, you know, it's just not good. 2.0 on a finger stick. But when I really dug in on this, I found that 0.5, which is technically you're not really in ketosis, that's an amazing limit. And at 0.8, you go into officially nutritional ketosis. But if you can raise your ketones to 0.5, two big hormones change. One of them is ghrelin, which is your hunger hormone. And the other one is CCK, which is your satiety hormone. So all of a sudden, you reset your body's hunger levels to your current body weight at 0.5. And the question is, how do you get there? The old way is eat no carbs for 4 days, lots of fat, and you'll get there. The new way is put brain octane in your bulletproof coffee and use a blood meter to see how much of it you require, but it will metabolize. I can eat 0.5. I can eat donuts. I don't eat donuts. Haven't had donuts in many years. But if I did eat them, or I can eat some other starch source, it doesn't matter. I can still hit 0.5 as long as I'm using enough of this enough brain octane. And that has been a game changer for me, because then I'm in control of my hunger. Then I'm not going to eat stuff I shouldn't be eating or don't want to eat.
Yeah. I think that's the two biggest things is, like, you know, when you start having some extra ketones, the cravings go away, which is, you know, if you struggle with cravings, and particularly if you're at the extreme end of, like, food addiction, food sensitivities, you know, carbs on your mind all the time, chocolate's on your mind all the time, you have to use caffeine consistently to increase your energy. Try adding some brain octane, because what it does, it just, the cravings disappear and you feel like a different person. Because when cravings are around, cravings are often in charge of you, and they deplete your energy, the kryptonite. And so that's the first thing cravings go, but also you get the smoother, more consistent energy as well. Because when people are wholly carb dependent, you know, that's when they used to say, when someone's wholly carb dependent, you got to eat five times a day. Well, that's true if you're carb dependent. But if you're not carb dependent and you're using healthy fats and you've got moderate amounts of protein and you're adding in brain octane, you don't need to eat five times a day. Actually, you probably need to eat just probably twice a day in a compressed window period of time, and you're going to feel great on it.
Right. Assuming, it, at least in my experience, especially for women in the morning, they probably want some protein and fat. So they might do three times a day, but they can certainly tolerate two times a day. But the intermittent fasting with nothing in the morning tends to be much harder for women. That's intermittent fasting, this new idea, the bulletproof intermittent fasting, which is fundamentally different. It's in the morning, you have bulletproof coffee, which has calories. It has butter, but it has no protein. So you're only activating your fat processing, not any of your protein or your sugar processing. That's just a different thing. But those tend to work really well. And that's why the Bulletproof diet sold substantially north of 100,000 copies now. And like it's an ongoing thing where people are like, oh, wait a minute. Like something big shifted for me when I started doing that. And you're seeing other health people who maybe previously would have been recommending lentils and things like that for their, you know, energy density or something. They're like, wait a minute. This idea of butter and coffee kind of works. And you're seeing it now in lots of places because it's so powerful.
And we're hearing about it all the time. And you know, intermittent fasting is a great idea, but it, you know, in reality, it's pretty challenging because if you don't have anything for breakfast, you know, people's moods go all over the place, energy crashes. That's why having the bulletproof coffee with the healthy fats in the morning really stabilizes it. You know, and there's always, you know, there's always caveats to this. For example, people with adrenal fatigue, you know, often will, you know, also need some sustenance in the morning as well.
So you've got to really protein,
Yeah, you've got to have some protein and some healthy fats. So you really got to work with your body. And so we need to move away from this idea that there's a fixed way of doing things right.
Yep.
There really isn't. It's about doing what's right for you, having experimental attitude, doing doing safe things, reading around the subject, educating yourself. But then really, once you hack it, and most people do pretty early on, you're just going to feel great. It is a game changer and is the foundation for mental health as well, because there's a lot of people here, you know, who'll be listening to this who do not feel good.
Right. And I was like that for years.
Yeah. You just can't. And likewise, you know, I experienced depression for a whole period of time in my life. Could never really understand why that was. Went up to my head and said, well, is it a psychology thing? And that's where people tend to go. It's a psychological issue. Well, actually, you know what? Often it's a biological issue.
Amen.
It's a blood sugar issue. It's not enough healthy fats or quality protein issue. It's a food allergy or sensitivity issue. It's a mold issue. And so if you do not feel good and you have mental health issues that have been labeled as depression or anxiety, throw away the label, put on your detective hat, and actually say, okay, I'm going to start with my diet. I'm going to clean it up. I'm going to start hydrating myself. And then see how that impacts on you. Keep away from the kryptonite food, the kind of food that to which you're sensitive or intolerant to. And the majority of people, particularly when they come off processed foods and sugar, will feel so much better.
I think you must have read our mind here, because Carolyn, who's age 32, just asked a question that you just half answered, which is great. No, this is perfect. And she said, do you have any good hacks for stress and anxiety? I've always been a stressed person and it's starting to affect my work and relationships. Please help. And you just nailed it there with what you said about kryptonite. And if you're having stress and anxiety, there is always an energetic component to it. And I don't mean energetic like, you know, we're meditating and you know, imagining unicorns, although there can be value in that. What I mean is, actually,
I'm pleased you believe that as well.
So. Yeah. You know, the rainbow pooping rainbow unicorns are the best ones for the squatty potty. Anyway, if you haven't seen that video, you got to go on YouTube and look at that, because it's the funniest video I've ever seen. Anyway, now we'll get out of our rainbow bathroom humor and back to stress and anxiety.
Yeah.
All right. So energetic. What I mean there, I mean bioenergy, as in fuel. So if someone is experiencing stress and anxiety, like there's this really amazing thing that can happen. This isn't the only source of stress by a long shot, but okay, blood sugar goes down because you have unstable blood sugar. Body says, there's not enough blood sugar in the brain. Survival emergency. I'm going to die. So let's secrete some adrenaline, which raises blood sugar, right? It also raises cortisol, which also raises blood sugar. So now your adrenal hormones and your cortisol went up. And when those go up, that now change your thyroid hormones. So your T3 hormone goes into reverse T3, which is a bit of a problem. And what ends up happening is, let's see, my blood sugar went back up and now my cortisol and adrenaline is high. So you end up creating this cycle where blood sugar goes up, blood sugar goes down. And when that happens, you are going to get food cravings and you're going to feel stress. In fact, a lot of the stress and anxiety that people feel, when you learn to divorce the stress and anxiety from your body, from what's actually going on in your mind, you'll realize that the vast majority of the stress that you feel is coming at you right here from your chest or your gut, or it's actually physically in your body. And it can be a response to a biological thing that has nothing to do with whether you're mad at the person with you, even if you treat them like crap because you didn't have enough glucose in the front of your brain. Yeah. This is my life. Like, I used to be a total jerk. And it happens. And it's when the kryptonite gets into you. And the kryptonite can come from a water-damaged building. That's why Moldy, the documentary, is out here. It can come from eating kryptonite foods or eating suspect foods that are okay for your friend but not okay for you. Okay. Like for me, you give me bell peppers. I actually like red bell peppers, right? But I eat those things. I feel stress and anxiety. Yeah. Download a Food Detective. This, Caroline, would be really good for you. Food Detective gets your heart rate. It's a free app from Bulletproof. And it gets your heart rate before you eat, and then you measure it after you eat. And if you eat a suspect food, something you're sensitive to, your heart rate's going to go up in a predictable way within 90 minutes after you finish eating. So I've had this happen. You're like, wow, like I actually noticed my heart rate is really high. Like you can feel it. You're like, oh, what did I just eat? Oh, yeah, there was some piece of something in there that I shouldn't have eaten. Yep. And it actually comes through as a stress response. And normal people, when there's a stress in the body, like I'm going to die stress, that the body's telling you, you believe it. And then all of a sudden, you know, your significant other is a total jerk and you wish they'd stop bothering you. But it was all about the food.
Yeah. Yeah.
What other hacks for stress and anxiety do you think about?
A whole bunch of things. This is an area that I'm really passionate about because a lot of people suffer necessarily. And so there's a couple of things. First of all, Caroline, I invite you to stop identifying yourself as a stressed person.
That's not going to work.
Yeah, it's not going to work. So we want to evolve that to, you know what, I experience stress from time to time.
Yep.
And it changes your relationship. There's many causes of stress. We've got the biological, and then you can have like thyroid issues. You can have adrenal fatigue can drive stress. You have food intolerances, food sensitivities, allergies, all those can drive stress. But then there's the psychological. And what they find is that people, a lot of people who experience stress and anxiety often believe a lot of their thinking.
Yeah.
Please do not believe your thinking, particularly if it's unhelpful. And so a really good hack is that start noticing the stories that go around your head, divide them into helpful, unhelpful. Mm-hmm. If it's helpful, it empowers you, it energizes you, it makes you a better human being. Be fused by it, be energized by it, use that story. If that story is depleting you as a human being and undermining your self-worth and leading to criticism of you or others or making you feel tired, lonely, then you want to what we call diffuse from the story. And there's a number of ways you can do that. The first thing is you can just tell yourself, wow, my head is creating a story that I'm not a good person. By doing that, you're creating a gap between who you are and the story, as opposed to, I'm not a good person.
There's a psycho living in most people's heads. If you take the voice in your head and you were to put it on your mom or a friend, you'd be like, that's the worst mother on the planet. That is not my friend. Yeah. And what I've learned through lie detector tests on my head, you know, the 40 years of Zen kind of work, as well as just advanced meditative practice, is that, look, there's a separate intelligence that's in the body that's only job is to keep the body alive, and it doesn't give a rat's ass about what you want. And if that's sitting in there going, you know, ah, you're a stressed person, you know, ha, 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 look at that, threat, that person wants your job, or, you know, whatever negative messages are going there, like you can draw a line there, and you can say, all right, so there's basically a crazy person who's running in my head, but it's not me. It's something that's there. It keeps me from getting eaten by tigers. It has a role, but I don't have to believe it, right? And then there's another voice in your head, which is like the voice of goodness. You got the angel on each shoulder. There's, you know, the nice one and the devil on the other one. Well, you're the angel one on your shoulder and the devil one. Yeah, okay. There's voices there. You can listen to them. You cannot. And the other tweak I would make on the language here, Mark, is instead of I experience stress from time to time, it's actually that my body experiences stress from time to time.
Very good.
Because when the stress comes in, it can literally be stress for a purely physiological reason. But most people will believe that it's actually a psychological reason. And sometimes it is. You may have PTSD, like you may get triggered by something.
Yeah.
And that's all good too.
Yeah, very good.
The other thing we didn't talk about is heart rate variability training.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan for anyone who experiences stress. I do this with clients all the time. It's like, look, get heart rate variability training equipment. And there's two ways to do it. The inner balance sensor, we carry it on the Bulletproof website. That thing works really, really well. And you hook it up to your ear. It works on your iPhone.
The other thing that's a little bit more affordable but works differently is called Stress Detective. It's a bulletproof app, and there you get a heart rate monitor. You wear it all day long for a few days, and it'll actually give you a graph all day long to tell you, okay, when are you stressed, when are you not stressed? And when you do that, you suddenly get a map of your stress throughout the day. But the most powerful thing I know is to sit there and just spend 15, 20 minutes feeling what it's like when the light turns red on this little sensor. It costs like $99 or something. And then feeling what it's like to make it go green. And pretty soon you realize, wait a minute, my body's experiencing a stress response and I don't like that. So I'm going to take my body with one breath out of stress mode into parasympathetic mode. You can do that. It's totally within your power. It's a learned skill. You can spend 2 years sitting in a monastery learning it, or you can spend 6 weeks with a sensor on your ear. It doesn't really matter, but like, it's totally within your control. Yeah.
And the great thing with heart rate variability training, as is biofeedback training, when you get moment by moment feedback, it accelerates your ability to master the skill.
Yeah.
So when it comes to stress, there's a couple of levels. It's like dealing with stress in the moment, building healthy self-care as practice. That means you're getting enough quality sleep. It means eating the right foods. It means taking downtime for rest and relaxation, fun stuff, that kind of thing. And there's also the deeper level of dealing with the big underlying drivers of stress. So for example, if you're in the grips of addictions, if you have a history of trauma and PTSD, if you experience codependency, which means that you fuse with another human being and you lose your sense of self, these are big drivers of stress. If you're in a job or being exposed to abuse or harm. So we need to be able to deal with our stress in the moment. We need to take good care of our self-care. But also, we need to be able to deal with the big things. Mm-hmm. And often then, you know, you may require the help of a trained professional to support you in that. That's often the case. So we need to work. So if you're under stress, learn how to deal with your stress. But also ask yourself, what's the most significant contributor here? Is there something outside of me that I need to attend to? If you're in a relationship that is demeaning to you, then you need to move out of the relationship. If you are using drugs of abuse, if you use alcohol addictively, then you need to get into addiction recovery and seek help of that. So there's so many different levels to the stress.
Yeah, if you have PTSD or if you have a codependence, the odds are about 100% that you don't know you have them. Yeah. And in fact, you probably get pissed off if someone tells you that you have them. I only know this because I've had them both. So I used to have codependent relationships all the time, and I don't anymore because I did my work. And I was born with a cord wrapped around my neck. So literally, I came into the world thinking something was choking me because it actually was. And I had no idea this had any bearing at all on my stress levels or anxiety or any of that kind of stuff. But it's a chronic background stress. And it's just like being colorblind. If it's always been there, how would you know that it wasn't normal? And for me, that was normal. And all of a sudden, it actually took 2 days of like focused work before someone's like, you have to be feeling something in your body. I'm like, yeah, I'm just kind of angry. And like, no, there's something else. And in fact, this was Barbara Findeisen from she's the head of the American Pre and Perinatal Psychology Association. She's like, well, no, there must be feeling. I'm like, oh, it's in my gut. She goes, yeah, there's a name for that feeling. I'm like, really? And she said, yeah, it's fear. I'm like, so I'm experiencing fear for no good reason right now? I had no clue because it had always been there. Yeah. And then I could work on it. So if you're stressed like that, like, and these basic things around fixing your food don't work, go to a professional. I recommend EMDR as the fastest way I know of in psychology if you're not going to do neurofeedback to just tweak on that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you know, it really is. You know, the final thing I want to leave you with is this idea of whenever you have a stressed mind, take your attention off your head and the story, turn your attention into the body, and notice what's happening in the body. And often you're going to find a whole bunch of tension sitting there. Yeah. Breathe into it. Part of mindfulness meditation practice, learning how to simply be with and allow and welcome the experience. And what that does, it automatically starts to relax it. So heart rate variability training, mindfulness training, meditation training, yoga, tai chi, find some kind of discipline practice, which you come back to yourself within your body, seeking professional help wherever you need to be, and not taking unhelpful stories personally.
And if that doesn't work, you can always like get a little doll of the person who's bothering you and just stab it over and over. Okay, maybe. Just kidding. So whatever that urge is, you got to get on top of it and understand it. Yeah. Next one up.
Okay, next one. Okay, so this is from Jennifer, age 39. how can you adjust the bulletproof diet to work with professional cyclists? For instance, cyclists requiring that much calorie and carb intake to be able to ride the bike and race as long as hard as they do, the 15 to 18 hour fast doesn't really work on a daily basis, especially during the race season. Can you adjust the bulletproof diet to specifically elite level cyclists?
The last thing I would recommend is someone who's during race season or during times of high physical burden, don't do intermittent fasting.
Oh my gosh.
Don't do bulletproof intermittent fasting. No. I see this a lot with CrossFitters. I'm like, guys, I know like you can get a little bit leaner that way. And with bulletproof intermittent fasting, at least you got the calories, but you're taking something out of your physiological bank account when you're pushing yourself that hard. And it doesn't matter if you're doing endurance or just heavy training of any form without recovery. And you'll see this, whether in heart rate variability, and you'll see this in your inflammatory things, the blood markers. So what you want to do is, this is going to be revolutionary, eat breakfast. But it's going to be a high-fat, moderate protein breakfast. And I don't recommend that you start out the ride with carbohydrates in the system. You don't need to, depending on how long the ride is. And what I've seen, especially in triathletes and all, is starting out with that carb, being fat adapted, having brain octane in the meal early on. Eat something that feels relatively light to you. Collagen protein may work really well. Some vegetables may or may not work really well for you. You're going to have to play around with that. And then you can eat as much as you need to. And yes, you can raise your carb levels. Your carbohydrate requirements are going to be much higher if you are during race season, and it's okay. But because you have carbohydrates doesn't mean you get to go have Gatorade and whatever else that's full of fructose and other sugar like that stuff. You want to still stick to the bulletproof template, which is, here are the suspect foods, eliminate the suspect foods. What are the starches that work better? And that means having some starch, but not necessarily, you know, pure sugar. However, during a race, halfway through the race, you want to switch over to brown sugar. You know, I have no problem with straight glucose, as long as it doesn't make you fart all the time, which it can. That's a bit of a problem, although for pro cyclists, it's like jet propulsion, so you're okay. that's my take on it. And I have not been a pro cyclist, but I used to ride 20, 30 miles a day on a road bike for years when I was fat. And I stayed fat, and my aerodynamic shadow wasn't very good, but I had fun with it. And it's that time somewhere halfway through, a third of the way through a race, depending on what you're doing, where you're going to need to switch over to carbs. Just because you switch over to carbs, though, you don't have to give up having ketones. You want to be burning two things. Put brain octane in the water bottle. You can actually do that. You can shake it up with whatever else you put in there. There's nothing wrong with having that and having even coffee during the race. I don't recommend bulletproof coffee, though, because the long chain fats that are in bulletproof coffee are not going to burn really efficiently. The brain octane, which is one of the four kinds of MCT oil. So this is not about generic MCT oil, which causes a lot more gastric distress, by the way. The last thing you want is disaster pants, or I guess disaster shorts when you're racing. But when you put brain octane in there, it forms ketones more easily than coconut oil or MCT oil. And it's these ketones you can burn. So in order to kick the most ass on a cycle, you want to have a source of glucose halfway through the race and a consistent source of ketones so you can use both. And that's going to give you the best results. And even if you're eating bananas the whole race, if that's your race fuel, that's okay. Take some brain octane with them. That's going to make a difference. I know a few cyclists actually use the bulletproof collagen bars along the way. You're going to have to test that one and see if that works for you or if it doesn't work for you. Different people, different ways, but that general template, be fat adapted, have lots of ketones in the system, burn out the glycogen you've got, and then start refueling it at the same time you refill the fat stores with brain octane. Anything else you'd say?
Nope, you got it.
All right, cool. Yeah, that was easy.
Yeah, that's bang on. Great. Okay. So Carolina Collister, age 31. Hi, Dave. Just wondering if I'm breastfeeding, if it is okay to drink bulletproof coffee. It is also okay to take glutathione force and eat your chocolate.
This is a big question. And if you've read the Better Baby book, I spent a lot of time looking at these issues, and I don't talk about them as much on Bulletproof. My wife, Dr. Lana, has a fertility coaching practice and answers these questions all the time. Yes, if you're breastfeeding, it's okay to make Bulletproof coffee. There's just one problem. You might not want to drink it. So here's how to do it right. Caffeine specifically passes through breast milk, and it can be stimulating for a baby. So very few people who are breastfeeding are going to be happy if they drink coffee, because their baby is going to not sleep as well, which means you won't sleep as well, which means that coffee actually makes you tired in that case. So the simple hack is decaf. But here's the issue. When your baby is getting breast milk and around the time of pregnancy, any form of toxin affects babies far more than it does adults. And decaf is well documented to be a higher toxin coffee. It's higher in the toxins that are used to make the coffee to be decaf. So there's basically solvents that are used. And the second problem is that beans that you would never, ever actually use to make good coffee, they'll decaffeinate those because some of the flavor is removed anyway. So I'm particularly cautious around recommending decaf during pregnancy because ochratoxin A, the primary coffee toxin, the one that is more present and even allowed to be more present per European regulations that don't even exist in the U.S., that toxin causes mitochondrial problems. These are cellular energy problems that are going to be more important for a baby than they are for an adult. So it's important for women and babies to avoid this stuff. So be very careful with the decaf you use. We use our bulletproof quality beans to do the decaf, and we use the solvent-free process. There's actually a lot more work that went into creating the decaf than there is the caffeinated coffee. So just be very careful there, and it's better to have no coffee than it is to drink moldy coffee. And you certainly, if you have, you know, a few sips of someone's coffee, it's not going to be a problem. But if you're going to have bulletproof coffee every day, you may see that there are issues with the milk. If you're pumping, you're also going to see that you may get caffeinated milk, and then you give that to the baby at night, and like your life is going to suck. Mm-hmm. All right. The other thing around glutathione force, absolutely. Yeah. Glutathione force is so good because you want to amplify your body's detoxing systems. Because if your liver can take it out, it will. If it can't take it out, it'll put it into the breast milk. So having higher levels of glutathione to help you get rid of the toxins from your diet and your body so they don't pass on to the baby, I think that is a really good idea. Lana certainly took glutathione the entire time she was pregnant and breastfeeding. In terms of eating the Bulletproof chocolate bars, they actually have some of the brain octane and XCT oil in them, so you get some of that extra oil. That oil, by the way, is profoundly important when you're breastfeeding. Up to 17% of breast milk can be the medium-chain triglycerides, at least some of them, but not all of them. So this means you want to be eating butter, you want to be eating coconut oil, and you want to be eating brain octane specifically to change the ratio of fats in your breast milk. Now, if you eat the chocolate, you're going to get some of those fats. You're going to get the amazing cacao powder, but a lot of babies are sensitive to the chocolate that the mother eats. So if you take, you just test it, eat the chocolate, see how the baby does, see if there's changes in energy or rashes or anything like that. And by the way, this could be true of any of the other suspect foods that are on the list, where bell peppers, grains, things that you used to think you tolerated, eggs sometimes, they pass through some proteins into the milk and then it doesn't work. So what I'd say there is you have to test the chocolate. There isn't that much caffeine in there. I think you'll probably be fine. But also beware, if the milk is pumped after the chocolate, there's a little caffeine, there's theobromine, and that may affect the baby if you give it to the baby at night. So I'd say chocolate, maybe, coffee, decaf, and make it bulletproof, and glutathione force all the time.
Yeah, good. So just on the glutathione front, mm-hmm. just to stress how important glutathione is, you know, it really is. And you know what? There is some good evidence correlating autistic spectrum disorder with low levels of glutathione as well.
In the mother or in the baby?
In the baby.
In the baby, right.
Yeah, and so that's been correlated.
Yeah.
And so we know that glutathione is really important in deactivating toxins, uh-huh. reducing oxidative stress. So we know that glutathione is really important for you. It's also really important to take in the liposomal form so it's properly absorbed.
Well, there's different science there, right? Like, so if you take glutathione, you can just buy it. It will digest in the stomach and you don't get it. It's just a bunch of expensive amino acids that way. So the first generation was to make liposomal glutathione, which means you wrap the glutathione in a kind of shell of fat so it absorbs. But that shell of fat only absorbs in the top like 5.5 inches of the GI tract. So it sits under your tongue and up here, but it goes into the stomach and it doesn't absorb very well. And then what we do with glutathione force is we use a liposome and we have a patented technology that adds a lactoferrin onto it. So it absorbs throughout the GI tract. And so you get in a study of this delivery system, not for glutathione, but just it's actually used exclusively in pharmaceuticals, except for us. Like we stole that from the pharmaceutical industry instead of the other way around like it normally is. And so in those studies, you get 5 to 8 times better absorption of whatever the molecule is using this technology versus liposomes. So the idea is to sort of like, how do we get it into the system? And frankly, If it's within your means, and if you're, especially if you're struggling or you're just really tired or something like that, get intravenous glutathione.
Yeah,
that's a game changer. I do that whenever I get a chance. I was in New York last week, and after that long flight out there, I slept 3 hours, was on Squawk Box, the CNBC show. And right afterwards, I saw a friend of mine and who a physician nutritionist there who does IVs and got a glutathione IV because like it just recharges you. So.
Yeah, it's safe, it's cheap, you feel the benefits pretty much straight away. One thing on the caffeine, just some kind of interesting facts around the caffeine, you know, so from mom drinking caffeinated drink to caffeine showing up in the breast milk, just 15 minutes, it peaks at 1 hour. The half-life of caffeine for an adult is between 2 and 6 hours, but for a newborn baby, it's 3 to 4 days.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so what happens is that the caffeine goes into the baby, and the studies that I've looked at show they get about up to 10% of the dose of caffeine ingested by the mother, but they have such a long T half-life that it stays in the system for significant periods of time.
Do you remember how long that is after birth?
Oh, I just remember it was a newborn baby.
Maybe newborn, The first 3 months, like babies don't even make melatonin. Like they have to get melatonin from their mother's breast milk. Yeah. Well, that's a neat hack. If you take milk that you pump at night and you give it to a baby in the morning, the baby's going to fall asleep. But if you take morning milk, which is high in cortisol, and you give it to a baby at night, the baby's going to be up all night and so are you. So like it's amazing how these systems have evolved. And I know that for children, but I don't know where the cutoff is between newborn and children, but it might be around 3 months. Children metabolize caffeine twice as fast as adults, which is why people say, oh my God, you give your kids bulletproof coffee. I'm like, yeah, when they turn 1 year old and they both actually actively are fighting me to get even black coffee, because apparently my kids always like coffee with no sugar, no nothing. But when we do it bulletproof, they just love it. So they get a little espresso cup. It's like 1 to 2 ounces, and they get it every morning. And the caffeine is negligible for their system, but the fat is not. And they like the taste. They like how they feel because they're getting the brain octane. And then they go to school and they don't need a snack, although their friends are all eating snacks. They might have one, they might not. But I have to eat. The children's cranky crash doesn't happen. And it's totally liberating as a parent, right?
You know, just one thing is I thought around the caffeine is like, I know we shared around decaffeinated, bulletproof decaffeinated is the ideal, but there's going to be a whole bunch of moms that are still going to have coffee because they're going to feel tired and stuff. And so I just want to say to you is like, I've looked at the literature of this, and you know, the general consensus is up to 300 milligrams a day almost certainly does no harm to the baby. So, So I want you to know, if you do have your cup of coffee in the morning, it's almost certainly not going to do any harm. Just monitor your baby, see what kind of happens. But you're pretty safe as long as you keep it to 1 or 2 cups, particularly early on in the morning.
It's also interesting, postum, which is this coffee, it's like a burned grain full of some really unusual toxins that was promoted as a counter drink against coffee back in the early 1900s. The people who did postum came out with these huge campaigns against coffee. And one of them was that coffee stunts the growth of children. And there's no evidence for that. Like they just sort of made this up in a marketing campaign so they could sell burned grains, which actually do stunt the growth of children. But so I don't think there's a safety issue. There's just a mother's sanity issue. And look, here's the deal. If you're going to like yell at your family, you're completely non-functional and you're like, you know what? A cup of coffee is what I need right now. It doesn't mean you're a bad mother. It actually means that you're human. And if you decide, I'm going to have this, even if baby doesn't sleep quite as well, you know what? You got everything done that you need to get done. Like, this is the world we live in. We don't have 2 hours a day to sit and meditate and om all the time and you know, eat perfectly. So you got to live. And even the same with adrenal fatigue.
Yep.
Like, if you're drinking one cup of mold-free coffee in the morning, and you have adrenal fatigue and it gives you your life back while you're recovering.
Do it.
I did. I've had like really bad adrenal fatigue. Don't do it all day, every day, but a little bit in combination with adrenal hormone, whatever. Yeah. Like you're okay.
You got it. Okay, great. Okay. Next question. So Becky, age 29, my husband is a lean guy. He's 6'9", 200 pounds. He exercises 3 to 5 times a week. But we found out he has pre-diabetes. His HbA1c is 5.8. I'll explain what that is in a minute. This was alarming news as his mother had type 2 diabetes. What would you recommend for someone who has pre-diabetes but is not overweight and already exercising? So I'd love to start on this, if I may.
Go for it.
Okay, so let's explain a bit about what pre-diabetes is. So pre-diabetes is essentially a condition in which your blood sugar levels are higher than what they should be, i.e. normal, but less than that which would diagnose you as being diabetes. The reason we're concerned about it is because a lot of people with pre-diabetes will eventually convert to diabetes. So pretty much within 10 years, most people with pre-diabetics will become diabetic. Now, there's an estimated 37 million American people have pre-diabetes, the majority of which do not know that they have it. It is a symptomless kind of illness. However, there's some clues that you may be at risk of it. If you're overweight or obese, your body mass index is 25 or above, unless you're pretty muscular, then you want to get checked for prediabetes. How do you do that? You get a blood test. The blood test is called HbA1c, which is glycosylated hemoglobin. You get the blood test done, it comes back. If it's between 5.7 and 6.4 inclusive, that provides a diagnosis of prediabetes. 6.5 or above is diabetes. You really want it below 5.4. So for yourself, for your husband, Becky, so your husband had 5.8. Now, I want to reassure you because it is a fully reversible condition. It's like, and I want to be respectful when I say this, I get excited when people come to me and say, I've been diagnosed with prediabetes. And the reason I'm excited is I'm saying, wow, this is great because you've picked this up before it's progressed to diabetes and it is fully reversible through diet, lifestyle change, changing the way you exercise through supplementation. And I'll talk a little bit about supplements, then we can talk about maybe changing the way your husband kind of exercises.
Yeah, yeah.
Your key supplements for prediabetes are vitamin D, alpha-lipoic acid, which is an antioxidant, chromium, magnesium, omega-3 essential fatty acids.
And maybe some cinnamon?
And you can add cinnamon, that improves insulin sensitivity as well. Those are your core ones. Any functionally integrated medicine doctor, nutritional therapist, they know all about that. So, and it's a good idea to work with someone who's pretty skilled in this area as well. So I'd encourage your husband to do that. But let's talk about exercise, intermittent fasting, kind of dietary stuff as well.
Well, there's two other things that'd be kind of cool. There are, in normal studies, drugs can give you about a 1% improvement in HbA1c.
Yeah.
And exercise done normally can do about a 1% improvement. So those are relatively small things.
Yeah.
Now, the question here for me, Becky, is you're like, well, he's been exercising 3 to 5 times a week and this is happening. Well, I don't know how else to put it. Like, exercise isn't what you do when you're fat, and exercise isn't what you do when the energy systems in the body are broken. It's actually how you spend energy, and it's possible for exercise to make it worse, not better. It doesn't always make it worse. Exercise is generally good for you, but water is also good for you too. However, you can drown. Right? Mm. So like it's actually not okay to say exercise is good or bad. It's the right amount of the right kind of exercise at the right time is going to be beneficial. And the other side of it is probably not. So what I'd want to know is, I'm guessing there's a lot of cardio involved here, which can affect your cortisol levels, which can also cause blood sugar swings that aren't necessarily beneficial. We also don't know what he's doing in terms of diet. My guess is if he's exercising 3 to 5 times a week, he's probably eating a lot of carbs. People who believe in the exercise paradigm as like, that's what you do to get healthy, I can eat what I want, it's not true.
It's not so.
And a guy who was one of the inventors of blade servers, this is one of the fundamental technologies that let data centers scale in the evolution of the cloud. Like, I guarantee you that some of the people listening right now are going through servers that are controlled by the patent this guy made. He was a semi-pro cyclist, a friend of mine in Silicon Valley. His name was Chris. And he died on Sand Hill Road at, I believe he was 43, my age. And he was a semi-pro cyclist. And he'd ride 50 miles before work, and just the guy made out of steel. And then he'd go have beer and pizza because, like, well, that's okay. The exercise cancels it out. And he actually, Lance Armstrong tweeted when he passed away, just an amazing, just super high energy guy. But what I'm saying there is that exercise doesn't cancel out diet. Diet trumps exercise every single time. So you got to look at, okay, 3 to 5 times a week is actually a heavy exercise schedule.
So maybe more intense but less frequent exercise, and very specifically, weight-bearing high-intensity exercise. I have a machine downstairs that is actually shown to improve HbA1c by 8.2%. Now, keep in mind, drugs are 1%, exercise is 1%, and this machine does 8%. What does it do? It causes your bones to flex. It's called a biodensity machine, and they're usually seen at very high-end, like doctor's offices or something. But you do four exercises that cause this bone flexion, which is replicating high-impact exercise. You don't want to do high-impact exercise. It's going to wreck your joints if you do it regularly. But essentially, you can get close to this by lifting as heavy as you can with your core muscles. So squats, deadlifts, things like that, those are going to actually stimulate a little bit of bone flexion, and that changes your hormones so that your blood sugar can correct itself better. And this isn't really well understood, but you can actually beat things. And finally, I would absolutely consider, and I know I'll piss some people off with this, I'd consider metformin, the anti-diabetes drug.
Oh, I'm a big fan of metformin.
Yeah. I've taken it for about 5 or 6 years. I'm not on it right now. Yeah. And I did it not because, actually, I did have pre-diabetes when I first was like, okay, I got to fix this. Mm. I believe my fasting blood sugar was around 112 or something. Mm. Not so good, 117. And the reason I started taking metformin had nothing to do with that. I already lost the weight. It was because metformin mimics the effects of restricting calories on your genes.
That's right.
So if you want to live a long time, metformin's considered to be an anti-aging drug.
It is.
The reason, though, that I'm concerned about metformin, there's two reasons. One is that if you Google metformin in mitochondria, it actually inhibits mitochondrial respiration, which, okay, maybe that's why you live longer, but I actually want my mitochondria to just kick ass. That's also an anti-aging strategy. Mm. The second reason to think about metformin is that metformin is shown to make permanent changes to your ability to absorb vitamin B12 from your diet. So your B12 receptors could be modified, and it may be irreversible. I've been on it for 6 years. But if I had pre-diabetes and it didn't respond within 3 months to improved exercise, eating the bulletproof diet and things like that, I would then consider metformin, and it wouldn't make me a bad person. It would make me a biohacker.
Absolutely. And I have a whole bunch of patients who, I tend to attract patients who are kind of anti-medications.
Yeah.
And then what I do is I say, well, hold a sec. This is an open field. We've got to intelligently look at what's best for you. Do what works and what is most safe. And a lot of them, I'll recommend taking metformin. Because because of its anti-aging effects, it can reduce B12 levels. So you've got to supplement with methylcobalamin as well. But it's a great hack. And I'm pretty convinced that between exercising intensely.
And infrequently.
And infrequently, maybe twice a week rather than 3 to 5 times a week. Intermittent fasting, of course, doing the bulletproof intermittent fasting.
Oh, that's huge. I didn't even say that one. Yeah. And that's a requirement at this point.
It is absolutely essential that, he experiments with that. One, he'll feel great on it. But two is that it just really improves insulin sensitivity. It'll bring down the HbA1c. You'll feel much better. Just one thing I want to finish on, just for people who are listening here. A lot of people don't know they're pre-diabetic or even diabetic. And so I just want to put out some of the symptoms to watch out for.
Yeah, let's do that.
So there's a couple of hallmark symptoms that indicate you have moved beyond pre-diabetes to diabetes, and they tend to be blurred vision, fatigue, thirst, increased urination. Those are the four kind of hallmark signs. So if you're listening to this and anything kind of rings true here, or you're overweight and age over 45, or overweight under the age of 45, but you have a family history of diabetes, heart disease, high cholesterol, you are of African American origin, Native American origin. If any of that is true for you, I really strongly recommend you check in with your doctor to get your HbA1c check, along with some other bloods as well.
Like vitamin D. You should get those two.
Core things like vitamin D, HSCRP, which is a marker of inflammation, would be great. There's loads, homocysteine, there's loads. But as a bare minimum, you could be doing yourself a huge favor, because if you pick this up quick, often my experience is it really motivates people to change their diet, change the way they exercise, add in some supplements. It's fully reversible. And then in a short period of time, with 3 to 6 months, most people see a good reversal.
The other thing I'd add, Becky, your husband is 6'9 and 200 pounds, so he's relatively thin. So not all people with prediabetes are going to be fat at all. In fact, it's more dangerous to have fat packed in around your organs than it is to have love handles.
But the other thing he should really probably take up is yoga, and that's because it's the only way he's ever going to fit on an airplane, just like me. All right.
And on that note.
Let's go to Charlie, age 40.
Okay, Charlie, age 40. Okay, there's a lot of exclamation marks in here. So this is actually, I was really pleased to see this question because it says, please help, exclamation mark, I've met my kryptonite. Someone broke a CFL light bulb. So that's a compact fluorescent light bulb. I cleaned it up and I was exposed to mercury. I don't know the best way to detox this, question mark. Help, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. I've got a whole bunch of things to say on this.
Yeah, I do too. Why don't you start?
Okay. There's a couple of things there's a whole bunch of different light bulbs. So let's just maybe do a review around that. There's the traditional incandescent light bulbs, which unfortunately are becoming a ban threat in North America.
Yeah, and stock up now.
Yeah, stock up now whilst it lasts. So the ban was introduced the last couple of years. Incandescent light bulbs, they work, electrical current goes to the wire filament, heats at the wire filament, emits light.
And it glows consistently.
Glows consistently. And then along came high energy efficiency bulbs, which, this kind of compact fluorescent bulb is. Now, this works very differently. So electrical current goes through a small tube containing argon and mercury vapor that then emits ultraviolet light, which interacts with a phosphorus lining on the inside of the light bulb. And then that emits light. But you've got a compact fluorescent light bulb because it takes ages to kind of to warm up.
Yeah,
it gets lighter like that. The problem is
they look like
mercury.
Curly too. Like they're the stupid curly bulbs you should not allow in your house.
There
ones.
You go. That's the one. So those are the compact fluorescent bulbs. And then you've got LED bulbs, which are light emitting diodes. And so what you're there is you've got this positive negative charge that brought together, creates energy, distributes as light. High efficiency. Now, the problem with the compact fluorescent light bulbs is they contain mercury, and not an insignificant amount as well.
They also make light that's toxic to our bodies in the absence of all the other spectrums, but we don't even talk about that side of them. Let's just go into the mercury side.
But yeah, I want to talk about that side, but we'll come back.
not in this episode. We'll run
not
out
in this
time.
Episode, right. Okay. So here's the deal. If a compact fluorescent bulb is broken, it is a hazardous situation to be in and needs to be taken seriously. And so there's a couple of things you need to do. And I know I'm not quite answering your question yet, but I just want to give the heads up to people listening to this. The first thing is you've got to get out of the room. You've got to open the windows. You've got to put fresh air into the room. Because what's happening is the mercury vapor is being released.
In fact, it needs to be more specific than that. I teach my kids this. Like if one of those bulbs breaks, you run. Like literally, you run out of the room. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't take one breath because the concentration is highest right where it breaks. Yeah. Literally, it's like there's someone dropped a really bad nerve agent. You don't want to breathe that. So you just get the hell out. You can come back and clean it up, but let it disperse so it's diluted before you expose yourself to it.
Yeah, it is. And you got to take it that seriously.
Yeah.
That's serious. And particularly if you're pregnant.
Oh, God, yeah.
Young children.
Mm-hmm. Babies. Yeah.
Babies, you just grab and go. And you leave the someone else to sort out.
You just
don't return.
Or if you're nursing, don't do it.
Yeah, you're right. And then you're going to go back and then you're going to clean it up. And often you use kind of stiff cardboard or whatever it is. And whatever you do, don't use a vacuum cleaner. And I hear this a lot where people say, I use the vacuum cleaner there. Because what's going to happen is that mercury is going to go into the vacuum and then you're going to distribute it around the house. So stay away from using the vacuum cleaner. You need to kind of tidy it using cardboard. Ideally, you then put it into a glass container that is sealable. But if you put it into a plastic bag, just realize the mercury vapor will still come off. And then you need to dispose of it responsibly. Now, depending where you live, the local authority will probably recycle it, etc. But it needs to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
But there's a whole bunch of things you need to do to protect yourself. The number one thing is to get out. Then the number two thing is you got to take liposomal glutathione. Because liposomal glutathione is a magnet.
Or glutathione force, which is better than liposomal.
Yeah, got it. And that's a magnet for mercury. And so that's how you support yourself. Any other kind of input on that?
Well, there's some evidence that activated charcoal can be good for mercury. And you should upregulate your antioxidants. So vitamin C would be really, really important. Alpha lipoic acid. And even high polyphenol foods, things like that can be really helpful. Turmeric, things like that.
Cilantro may be a good idea when you first get exposed to it. Cilantro is another chelating agent. Bentonite clay also has been used. So the idea here is to bind these things.
I'm a little concerned because Charlie here, who broke the bulb, doesn't say what happened. You know, I've met my kryptonite. Someone broke a bulb and I cleaned it up and I was exposed. But we don't know what symptoms. Mm. And here's the thing. You may clean it up and just be like, oh my God, I have brain fog. My joints hurt. I feel terrible. You may also have no symptoms at all. And you could just have stress and anxiety. Like the degree of variance here is very high. There are studies of people who work in mercury mines. Mm. And in fact, mercury polluters love to use these studies. Mm. And like, oh, look, see, there's no problems at all. And what actually happens is that people who work in the mercury mines quit after 6 weeks because they're too sick to keep working if they're susceptible to mercury. Yep. And the ones who have unusual genetics who can basically swim in mercury, they keep working there and they think everyone else is crazy.
Yeah.
So like the degree of susceptibility is different. The other thing that you mentioned that's really important is getting rid of the broken glass. Mm. There was one case I know about. It's anecdotal, but it's still evidence because it's an observation. Is a parent had a broken CFL in their young child's bedroom. And so, it's broken, whatever. They swept it up, tossed it into the trash can in the bedroom. And the child was exposed to the vapor, right, and it broke, and slept with the shards in the room and woke up neurologically changed. The baby ended up having autism and just a profound behavior changes from one day to the next that were almost certainly related to that.
Wow.
What this means for you is get that out of your house. As in, don't use those bulbs. There's no biological reason. They're hard on your eyes. They create oxidative stress on your cell membranes throughout your body. They'll probably give you macular degeneration if you use them for many, many years. They flicker at a rate that is imperceptible to you but causes stress in your body. They have no place in your house. And anytime they break in a room, which does happen with light bulbs regularly, they actually create an EPA toxic site. Like, you should have people in hazmat suits come and clean it up if you believe the regulations of our own government about mercury exposure. So why are you putting these in your house? It's an unconscious act, and it's time to stop. What's better? Halogen and incandescent provide the most biologically compatible light. Halogen's more effective, about 30% more efficient than incandescent bulbs. And from there, LEDs are way more energy efficient. They're also five times more suppressive of melatonin than even fluorescent bulbs. So in my house, I have halogen lights, the 12-volt halogen lights, regular halogen lights most of the time. And I have LED bulbs outside the house, but those are red LED bulbs. Because if you put LED bulbs outside because they're cheap, guess what lives outside? Birds and stars, and you kill both of them. So if you want to be killing stars, as in no one can see them anymore because of your light pollution, just put LED bulbs all over your backyard. Otherwise, dim exterior lighting, red spectrum, you can see, and it doesn't affect insects, doesn't affect birds. I'm not going to affect the bald eagles and the owls and the sea creatures that can actually see my house. So at night, I look like I'm a vampire, but I'm biologically healthier, and so is the world around me.
Okay. Really, really good question. Hugely important subject.
Well, that was a fun way to end things, talking about red lights on the outside of your house. Didn't think we'd get there in today's episode, but Mark, it's always fun to do these. So we're going to do a few more of these because the feedback that I hear on these is really good and that people just like being able to ask the questions.
That's great.
So if you like this, head on over to Facebook, head on over to our forums and ask a question. And we've got full instructions there on how you can actually leave us a question with a voicemail as well, which is kind of cool. So we can play the question out loud. However we do it, though, ask the good stuff. And if lots of people are interested, I'll go there. Mark will go there and we'll answer it. So thanks for listening. Check this out on iTunes. Just head on over and leave a review. It's one of the biggest things you can do. Something else you can do that might be fun is not very long ago, I just finally joined Instagram personally. And we have the Bulletproof account on Instagram where you'll see all kinds of cool stuff that's related to Bulletproof. And on the Dave.Asprey Instagram account, I'm posting all sorts of crazy pictures of stuff that I'm doing that probably won't make it to the level of Bulletproof, but it's still a lot of fun. So that's Dave.Asprey on Instagram. Have an awesome day, and we'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
The
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.